I've often felt that as you get older, you get more invisible. Did any of you grow up, move away from home to college or the military or career, come back and find that your father had changed and was a much nicer man? Have any of you known anyone who, whenever in high school, was arrogant, partying along with, years later you met them at a reunion, and they turned out to be really neat as they grew up? Have you ever seen anybody change for the better? In the book of Jeremiah, it appears that this has happened. Jeremiah hasn't really changed. But if you start in this Old Testament prophetic book, through which God sends the prophet Jeremiah to tell Israel that they're in trouble because of their sins, and he goes on for chapter after chapter about gloom, coming, destruction, and so forth. Then when you reach the chapters that we begin today, chapters 30, 31, 32, and 33, it's like you're reading a totally different person. In Jeremiah chapter 30, here's how the prophet begins his words. This is the word that came to Jeremiah from the Lord. This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Write in a book all that I have spoken to you. No. Another book from Jeremiah. Another scroll in which he writes things down. You remember the scroll that he dictated to his helper, a man named Baruch? Baruch, I have to hide for my life because my sermons have been so bad and so discouraging to people that they all want to kill me. So, let me write a scroll for you, and would you please go to the temple where everybody's gathering and reading? So Baruch goes upstairs to an upstairs window overlooking the temple courts where people from all Jerusalem and Israel have come in order to pray to God to save them from the oncoming Babylonian army. And then Baruch reads all the predictions of God, all the doom and gloom, promises of dread and misery, promises of slow death and certain captivity because they have long ago abandoned the Lord, promises of a siege and of a famine, and of Jerusalem's very walls collapsing, and of the sword coming and slaying young and old, men and women, even children. Promises from God of the survivors being clamped into shackles and dragged in chains to walk hundreds of miles to a foreign land where they would live in exile and never see the land of their home. 29 chapters of misery is one of the reasons people find it so hard to read the book of Jeremiah. It's one of the reasons he's called weeping prophet. Now God says, get up and write another scroll. Chapter 30, verse 2. Write in a book all the words I have spoken to you. Quote, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will bring my people back from captivity and restore them to the land of their forefathers. People blinked. Really? Chapter 30, verse 18. I will restore the fortunes of Jacob's tents and have compassion on his dwelling. This is just another way of talking about Israel. Jacob was the father of 12 boys who became the fathers of the 12 tribes of Israel. And so when he talks about Jacob, he's talking about the nation of Israel as if we were to say, if we would call Americans now George Washington's children. It's the same idea. And when he says, I will restore the fortunes of Jacob's tents, he's using poetic language. Back in the early days when the Israelites had left Egypt as slaves and wandered in the desert on the way to the promised land, they lived in tents. It was the earliest days, like the honeymoon of them and God when he rescued them and was now going to make them into a nation. And so when they hear about Jacob's tents being restored, nobody lives in tents anymore, they think about the early days when they went on a honeymoon with God and they were a newly formed nation, and it was wonderful. I will restore the fortune of Jacob's tents and have compassion on his dwellings. Understand, this is at the time when the Babylonians are right at the door, about to crush them in Jerusalem and take them all in exile. This is what The city, Jerusalem, will be rebuilt on the ruins, and the palace will stand in its proper place. The palace will stand again? You mean the palace of all these wicked kings who have led our nation into such a debacle that you're going to drag us off into slavery by foreigners? You mean the palace that King Jehoiakim lived in? Here, this wicked man, the one who lined the inside of his palace with expensive cedar while so many other people were starving to death? The one who refused to pay any of his workers and made them work as slaves? Yes, yes, that palace, that will be restored. And God, you say that the city will be rebuilt on the ruins? Do you mean the city that you said back in chapter 6, verse 6, where God said, cut down the trees and build siege ramps against Jerusalem because this city must be punished? The city that the Babylonians, in a few chapters from now, are going to burn to the ground? Yes, that city is going to be rebuilt. Chapter 31, verse 8, Jeremiah continues, see, I will bring them back from the land of the north, and I will gather them from the ends of the earth. He means I'll bring them back from captivity in Babylon. Now you say, now wait a minute. I can read a map. Because I was born before GPSs were invented, and I just used a phone. And on the map, I can see that Babylon is to the east of Israel. It's not to the north. Why are you saying I will bring the people back from the land of the north? The reason is this. The reason is there a slide that goes with this? The reason is, far to the east is Babylon. Far to the west is Jerusalem. Between the two is a desert. And so if you want to get to Jerusalem from Babylon, you can't just go straight across. You always have to go north along the place where there's enough rain called the Fertile Crescent. And by the time you come down to Israel, you're coming down from the north. And therefore, God says, I will bring my people back down from the north. Well, who is it that God is going to bring back? Are these just soldiers? A few Jewish mercenaries, perhaps, who were fighting their way back to the land of Islam? Oh no, chapter 31, verse 8. Among the people who return will be the blind and the lame, expecting mothers and women in labor. A great throng will return. Chapter 31, verse 11. For the Lord will redeem them from the hand of those stronger than them. They will come and shout for joy in the heights of Zion, and they will rejoice in the valley of the Lord. And what's going to happen when these people get back? Well, this is the maidens will dance and be glad, and the young men, and the old as well, they're going to dance too. I will turn their mourning into gladness. I will give them comfort and joy instead of sorrow. And in these four chapters, 30, 31, 32 and 33, one of the most depressing books of the Old Testament becomes one of the most encouraging. Here's what God says he's going to do for these people. He makes clear in these chapters that he is going to make miserable the enemies of God's people who have been made miserable. He's going to take those enemies and do to them what they had done to Israel. Chapter 30, verse 16. All who devour you will be devoured. All your enemies will go into exile. Those who plundered you will now be plundered. Chapter 51, I'm borrowing from the end of the book now, verse 56. A destroyer will come against. You almost wince when you hear these words because you think he's going to say again, a destroyer is going to come against Jerusalem where you people live. No, no. A destroyer is going to come against Babylon, the people who are attacking you. Her warriors will be captured, and their bows will be broken. For the Lord is a God of retribution, and he will repay in full. That is, he is going to punish the people that he used to punish his own people. Chapter 51, verse 58. This is what the Lord says. Babylon's thick wall will be leveled, and her high gates will be set on fire. What is going to settle this emotion? What is going to make Babylon, that seems so strong now, absolutely invincible, impenetrable, nobody can possibly stand against her, what is going to make Babylon fall? Well, there's a story near the end of the book of Jeremiah, chapter 51. It comes at the end of the book when the Babylonians have indeed come. They've indeed leveled Jerusalem. They indeed are getting ready to take everybody into exile. All the people they haven't killed, they've killed a great many of them. And the exiles are all standing in a chain gang ready to leave. One is chained to the next, two is chained to the next. The great and small alike, they are required to put their eyes downward on the ground. They are not even allowed to look around longingly at their homeland as they leave. And we read that as they're getting ready to leave, Jeremiah, who has been set free by the Babylonians because they knew that he prophesied that Israel would fall, Jeremiah comes up to one of the men in the chain gang, one of the Jews, getting ready to be exiled. Chapter 51, verse 61. And so Jeremiah said to a certain man named Seraiah, when you get to Babylon as an exile, here's a scroll. See that you read all these words aloud. The scroll contains prophecies against Babylon, saying that one day it is going to fall. He says, read these words aloud, and then say, quote, O Lord, you have said that you will destroy this place, so that neither man nor animal will live in it, and it will be desolate forever. Do you understand the place he's talking about? You, Seraiah, are in Jerusalem. You are going far to the east in exile to Babylon. When you get to Babylon, as you're standing in the very shadows of the walls of the great empire that has conquered us, you are to read aloud this prophecy I'm giving you, that the walls of Babylon are going to be destroyed, and that Babylon will be a desolate place so that neither man nor animal will live in it. And then he says, Seraiah, when you get to Babylon as an exile, chapter 51, verse 63, when you finish reading this scroll, tie a stone to it and throw it in the Euphrates River. The Euphrates River is, of course, the great river that runs along Babylon. And then say, as the scroll sinks, quote, so will Babylon sink to rise no more because of the disaster that I, the Lord, will bring upon her, and her people will fall. And the way it's written, you almost get the idea that the action that is going to set in motion the fall of Babylon is this prophecy Jeremiah is giving, that he's put on a scroll, that he's rolled up, that he's given to Seraiah, the Jewish exile, that Seraiah will take flight to the east, that Seraiah will unroll and read in Babylonia itself, that he will tie a stone to, and that he will throw to the great Babylonian river of the Euphrates. And when that happens, it's like the trigger is pulled. And these prophecies start to move. And the clock starts to tick. And now God's judgment that is going to be several decades away is slowly coming on that awful nation. And what's really a nice touch is this. It is the man that God picked through Jeremiah to be the messenger of this scroll. Remember the next thing we read in chapter 51, verse 59? This is the message that Jeremiah gave to the staff officer Seraiah, the son of Neriah, when he went to Babylon. And as so often in the Bible, something that seems so small and insignificant is so highly significant. You know who Seraiah is? Well, says right in this verse, he is the son of a man named Neriah. If you read back in chapter 36, this man Neriah has another son. That son's name is Baruch. Baruch, the friend and helper of Jeremiah, who bravely read his scroll to the people that they did not want to hear. Baruch is going to get dragged to Egypt and killed down there. But Baruch's brother is going to get dragged to Babylon and die there. But just like Baruch read Jeremiah's scroll to the Israelites, that Babylon will fall after they fall. So Seraiah, his brother, will go to Babylon and read that that nation will fall. And so God uses two brothers, both of whom will suffer greatly in this life, to accomplish his purposes in this world, and then takes them to heaven. And my goodness, do they enjoy it today. The whole idea here of the Babylonians falling, and of is a lot like if a gang in a city comes inside the store of a little shop owner, robs him blind, beats him black and blue, breaks half of his bones, and then, laughing, they back off into the street with their bags of money. And as they back out into the street, a truck comes by and runs them over. Everybody goes, yes, yes, that's the part we hear, that God is going to serve justice to the very people and do to them what they did to other people. That's the first thing that God promises he's going to do. He's going to do to other people what they have done to the Jews. Secondly, he says that God is going to bring his people back to the land of Israel. My goodness, think about this. Suppose you were shot. Suppose you got beaten to within an inch of your life. Suppose as that gang backed out of the store, all their bones got broken by a truck running over them. Well, that's great. But you're still in the hospital in a body cast, not able to move, and maybe never really heal again. But what God says, it's not just that I'm going to bring it down the heads of the guys who did this to you. I'm going to heal you. I'm going to fix you. I'm going to bring you back to this very land that I gave you in the first place. He says that in chapter 30, verse 10. I will surely save you out of a distant place, meaning Babylon. And I will save your descendants from the land of their exile. Chapter 31, verse 23. This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. People will live again together in Jerusalem and all its towns. Have any of you moved from the place where you grew up? From the town where you lived? Particularly if you had a happy childhood. Streets that you ran around on. The places you rode your first bicycle. The roads on which you drove your first car after you got a license. The place where you played ball with all the guys. Or the place where you went to high school. The place where you had many good memories. Have you ever gone back to the place where you lived before? Some of you know what it's like to go back and it's horrible. It's all changed, it's gone, it's run over, their highways over now. But others of you have gone back to a place and there it is. And it's almost like it was when you grew up. And it's so sweet. This, he says, is what it will be like for my people. After I finish chasing them, I will bring them back to this very land. And what is neat and hard to believe is God is not just going to bring Judah, the southern several tribes, back. He says in chapter 30, verse 3, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will bring my people Israel and Judah back from captivity and restore them to the land I gave their forefathers. I have never thought about this until this week. Here's the idea. The nation of Israel, as you probably know, had a very sad history. Israel first was divided into 12 tribes when God first gave them the promised land. Now, about 3 centuries before the time of Jeremiah, the nation of Israel had a civil war and it split. I'd like to say it split right in half, but it didn't. 10 of the tribes from the north broke off from the worship of God in Jerusalem, and only 2 stayed in the south. The south is called Judah. The south is Judah, and Jerusalem is its capital. But the north maintained the name Israel. Now, because of the tribes in the northern part, because one of the largest and most influential tribes was the tribe of Ephraim, the northern nation is sometimes not just called Israel, it's sometimes called Ephraim. Its capital was Samaria. And it set up a rival worship to Jerusalem, where they worshiped Jehovah in a way that displeased him. It was exiled over a century before Jeremiah's time. Now the prediction is this, in Jeremiah 31:5. When you come back to the land, again you will plant vineyards on the hills of Samaria. The farmers will plant them and enjoy their fruit. This is astounding. The northern nation had not existed for about 135 years. He says in chapter 31, verse 6, there will be a day when watchmen cry out on the hills of Ephraim, which was what the northern part was often called. Come, let us go up to Zion, to the Lord, our God. The reason is that God loves the northern part of his people, just like he loved the southern part of his people, even though they were more wicked. He says this in chapter 31, verse 20. Is not Ephraim my dear son, the child in whom I delight? Though I often speak against him, I remember him. Therefore, my heart yearns for him. I have great compassion for him. May I ask you this? Are there any Christians in this room that you know you have drifted seriously from God? Are there any Christians in this room, after you have drifted, God has dealt pretty severely with you? God has pierced your conscience till you could already stand. God has brought suffering to you to bring you back that has made you ache to the very core of your bones. If you are truly Christ's, here's what he says, though I speak often against him, I still remember him. Therefore, my heart yearns for him. I have compassion for him. And he's talking about people here who are going through misery in their lives right now because they have rebelled and God is chasing them. I'm going to bring you back, he says. And then he promises not only will he deal with Israel's enemies, and not only will he bring them back to the land, but he says that they will experience and taste the joys of everyday life again that they have so missed and longed for. Chapter 31, verse 12. They will come and shout for joy on the heights of Zion. Zion is just another name for Jerusalem. They will rejoice in the bounty of the Lord, the grain, the new wine, and the oil, the narrow bread, and all kinds of restaurants that have all kinds of good things to eat. The young of the flocks and their herds, they will sorrow no more. And then the maidens will dance and be glad, and the young men and old men will dance as well. And I will turn their mourning into gladness, and I will give them comfort and joy instead of sorrow. He's talking about people who cannot keep a straight face because they keep breaking into a grin because of how good God will be to them, despite how much they have rebelled against him. And then he promises them what they can hardly believe. He promises them that the city of Jerusalem will be built again. In chapter 32, verse 31, God had said this about Jerusalem. From the day it was built until now, this city has so aroused my anger and wrath that I must remove it from my sight. But here in our passage, chapter 3, verse 18, he promises, the city will be rebuilt on her ruins. And in chapter 31, verse 40, he says, the city will never again be uprooted or demolished. Oh my goodness. Do you remember what happened in Hawaii not too long ago? When some guy set off an alarm that was a false alarm, the nuclear missiles were coming in. And everybody ran, and it lasted for, I don't know, I think the better part of a half an hour, where people actually thought that their whole island was going to be blown to smithereens, and they did not know if they would ever see the Hawaii that they knew again. Do you recall that? What was going through their minds? I haven't interviewed any of these people. We have a couple from our church, Ben Dismount, who grew up in this church. Ben did, and just lived here for years, and now they live in Hawaii. What was going through the minds of people living here at the time? I imagine things like this. They're picturing the house they grew up in. They're picturing playing on the streets when they were kids. They picture the school they went to. They picture the church they worshiped in. They picture the playgrounds they ran around in. They picture the parking lots where their cars were. They picture all the places dear to them. They picture the place where they were married, perhaps. And now they picture it all gone, so if ever the nuclear waste subsides and they're able to come up from their underground shelters, all they see is a desolate wasteland. God says, it is going to be rebuilt, as they remember. And then he says, finally, in chapter 31, verse 36, he says, listen, you know how I appoint the moon, and every single night it comes out except when it goes to, you know, the day the moon is all dark. And you know how I appoint the sun, and every single day it rises. And you know how I put the stars, and those stars never go away? Here's what he says in chapter 31, verse 36. Only if these decrees vanish from my sight, that is the decree to have sun and moon and stars, which are permanent. Only if these decrees vanish from my sight, declares the Lord, will the descendants of Israel ever cease to be a nation before me. This is probably the most astounding of all. He says, when I bring you back, you will never again cease to be a nation, ever. You think of the security that's promising. That is promising that they will never be overrun by foreigners again, period. It's astounding what God promised these people, having chewed them out for so long about such serious sins. So the big thing we're saying here is that God promised his sinful people restoration and promises beyond their wildest dreams. Second, these promises that God gave in these chapters were fulfilled in a real but ultimately disappointing way. Have you been thinking about this while we've been reading these promises? I know some of you have. Yes, Babylon was totally destroyed some decades later, as God promised. And yes, as God promised that Babylon would never be rebuilt, so today, in 2018, the city of Babylon has still never been rebuilt. Those of you who are old enough to remember Saddam Hussein and the Iraq War, shortly before then, Saddam had promised that he was going to rebuild Babylon on its ancient site, because Babylon is in modern-day Iraq. He never got to do it, and he never will get to do it, because God has promised absolutely that city will never be rebuilt. That prophecy has been totally fulfilled today. And yes, the city of Jerusalem got rebuilt. You remember what the city was like in Jeremiah's day? It was a wonderful city of Jerusalem that all the people loved and hated the thought of the Babylonians knocking down. And then that whole city was destroyed by the Babylonians. Ah, later it was rebuilt when God brought the people back. And it was rebuilt. And under Ezra and Nehemiah and others, God took the walls up, he brought the temple back up, and the people lived in Jerusalem. And by the time of Jesus, it was a magnificent temple, and even bigger, it was a wonderful place. And then 40 years after Jesus died, the Romans leveled it in AD 70. How can God say it will be rebuilt, and yet he just knows it's going to be leveled again? What good is that? And yes, the people returned to the land, and they became a nation again under Ezra and under Nehemiah. But when they returned to the land, they weren't free Jewish people. There wasn't a free Jewish state. They returned under now not the Babylonians, but the Persians, who, yes, allowed them to rebuild the city, but still kept them under its thumb. And then after the Persians came the Greeks, who did the same. And then after the Greeks came the Romans, who did the same. And finally, the Romans leveled the city. And over the years, it was rebuilt here and there in scattershot fashion. And the Jewish people were dispersed over the entire world. And the Jewish people, as a people, I am sorry to say, have been hated worldwide ever since in a way that is totally irrational. Why are these people so despised? How they were hated in the times of our fathers under the Nazis. Millions and millions destroyed in the concentration camps. How they are hated and scattered all over the world today and despised on every continent of the world in a highly irrational way. So God gives these promises, and yet they're fulfilled in a manner that is true but disappointing and unsatisfactory, and still remains in a manner that gives people longing. The third and final point is this. Jeremiah's prophecies were meant to be fulfilled in a more wonderful way than the people of his day could ever possibly imagine. Here's what that looks like. Jeremiah predicted the fall of Babylon. And true Babylon, just a number of decades later, in 539 BC, was itself destroyed by the Persians. Finally, Babylon fell. But then the Persians became the oppressors. And as I said, after that, the Greeks became the oppressors. And after them, the Romans. And after them, all the people all across the world who have persecuted both Jews and God's later people, Christians. Babylon in the Bible was used by God to be victorious of the enemies of God's people that would always be throughout the history of the world. It was a literal empire. It did literally destroy Jerusalem. Those Israelites did literally get restored 7 years later. And Babylon's own walls did literally fall. But the fall of Babylon of old, the enemies of the Jews, was just the warm-up. It was just a preview before the main attraction. What it was a preview of is what God is going to do at the end of the world to all the persecutors who have ever harmed his people in any country and in every age. And that is given in the book of Revelation, the final book of the Bible, the entire chapter 18. It begins like this. Remember, book of Revelation, end of the world, chapter 18, what happens at the end of time? Revelation 18, verse 1. The Apostle John says this: "In my vision, I saw another angel coming down from heaven." He's speaking far into the future now. "The angel had great authority. The earth was illuminated by his splendor. And with a mighty voice he shouted, 'Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great.'" Well, how can that be? I thought God said that Babylon would never be rebuilt. And didn't you just say this to Saddam Hussein tried to rebuild it and it wasn't rebuilt? How did Babylon fall? It's because when he talks about Babylon here, he's not just talking about a little place in Iraq. He's talking about the entire system, political and militarily, of the world in its hostility toward God and his people, toward the Jewish people of old and to the Christian people of today. People who hate God, his truth, his Bible, his church, his nation, his people. They are collectively in the Bible referred to as Babylon. And God says at the end, he is going to do to the enemies of his people what he did back in the 6th century BC. Revelation 18:1-10. People will cry when they see it. "Woe, woe, O great city, O Babylon, city of power. In 1 hour your doom has come." Revelation 18, verse 21. "Then a mighty angel picked up a boulder the size of a huge millstone and threw it into the sea and said," quote, "with such violence, the great city of Babylon will be thrown down, never to be found again." He is talking about the end of the world. When God is about to judge his planet for its rebellion against him and its hatred of him and his people, and God reaches down and plucks out his people and makes them safe, and then destroys the entire universe, as he has promised. And the great world system that basically shakes its fist at God, God will wipe away a single day. Well, what about the promise that they are going to return to the land? And then Jerusalem's going to be rebuilt. That sounds exciting. Well, it was exciting. Do you remember in chapter 30, verse 3, Jeremiah predicted the days are coming when I will restore to my people, says God. I will restore them to the land that I gave to their forefathers. Well, do you remember when the Israelites left Babylon and came back to Jerusalem under Ezra and Nehemiah and start the nation of Israel again? Little Israel and little Jerusalem was so very much small. And do you remember how, even today, when you look at the nation of Israel today, you think, well, the nation of Israel has been rebuilt in 1948. It became a nation again. Thank God that it did. But if you look at the map of the nation of Israel in Old Testament times, and you look at a map of the nation of Israel today, oh my goodness, it's a pathetic little thing. Parts of the ancient nation are today owned by Egypt. Parts of the ancient nation are today owned by Jordan. Both Islamic nations. Parts of the ancient country of Israel are now the West Bank, where the Arab nations worship Allah. And it just doesn't seem like it's a satisfying fulfillment. Here is how the Bible treats Jeremiah's prophecy that the people will come back from Babylon to Israel. First, it says that 70 years later, they did come back. A tiny group of them, a remnant of them, a small number came back, and they built a city. And when they laid the foundations of the temple of the city, people wept. The younger ones wept because they were so happy that finally we're back in the land I told us about. The older ones wept who had been carried off into exile because they remembered the grandeur of the old city and how tiny and pathetically small the new city that was rebuilt was. Here's how the Bible says Jeremiah's predictions are filled. It comes in the New Testament. It comes in one of the letters of the Apostle Paul. And it comes in the Romans, chapter 4, verse 13. Paul wrote, Abraham, who came many years before Jeremiah, father of the Jewish nation, Abraham and his offspring received the promise that he would be the heir of the world. Wait a minute, you said, I'm sorry, I don't get that. As I recall, Abraham was promised that he would be given the land, meaning the land of Canaan. Well, it's an interesting fact in the Hebrew language that the word land and the word earth are the same word in the Hebrew language. And God says to Abraham, I'm going to give you this land. And he's picturing this land. But God is picturing something bigger than the land. God is picturing, and God says it in Romans 4:13, that God intended to give Abraham and his descendants, the Jews, and their descendants, all the Christians of the world, who are followers of the one true God, the entire world. He talks about that in Revelation 21:1, again, the last book of the Bible. John says, then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away. The land that God intends to give his people is this entire planet, known in the future as the new earth. And the city of Jerusalem is going to be rebuilt. Well, remember the earthly city? Remember how we said it was destroyed? And remember when they came back, they built it, but it was a tiny little thing? And even by the time it got bigger, by the time Jesus and Herod, it was destroyed again? Well, here's how God is going to fulfill that prophecy of that city being rebuilt. Again, the book of Revelation chapter 21, verse 2, speaking about the very end of time, when Jesus Christ comes back and takes all of his people, Jews and Gentiles both, those who are of the true Israel, that is, both the Jewish people and the Gentile people who belong to him, Revelation 21:2, at the end of time, in my vision, I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. When he talks about this city being rebuilt, it was never totally fulfilled. It has never been totally fulfilled. It will never be totally fulfilled until the day when you set foot at the end of time in the new Jerusalem that will never be left. John said in Revelation 21:3, and I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, now, that is at the end of time, happened. Now, the dwelling of God is with men, and he will live with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be their God. Where do you think John, in that chapter, got that phrase, God himself will be their God? He got it from Jeremiah chapter 31, verse 33. Jeremiah's prediction has to do not just with Jewish people. It has to do with you. It is a prediction that every true child of his, who has ever lived or ever will live, who has been oppressed, who has been persecuted, who has been made fun of, who has been marginalized, will one day be in the new city that has been rebuilt that will last forever. And God promises, I myself will be their God, and they will be my people. Now here is the deal. Tucked in the middle of these four marvelous chapters that I was going to finish today, but they're too good, I have to have at least one more week. I'm sorry. in the middle of Jeremiah's prophecy, in chapter 30, verse 24, is this tiny little verse. See if this verse makes any sense to you in light of what we talked about today. Jeremiah, he says, in days to come, you will understand this. Why does he say that? Because in his day, it was impossible to understand. Because in his day, Jesus, the Messiah, had not been born. Because in his day, we hadn't realized that God was going to become a man and was going to do for all his people of all ages things that outstripped anything that the Jews could possibly imagine he was going to do for them. Jeremiah is writing about what Jesus is going to do. Rather than sing a hymn as a congregation to close, we're now going to hear a song for the musicians' qualities. We're now going to hear a song that is taken from the prophetic books of the Old Testament. Almost every line of this song is lifted from one or more of the prophetic books of the Old Testament, where God talks about his people, Israel, who were supposedly to be worshippers of him, who had come to worship Baal, and that's why they were sent into exile. And he calls them the daughter of Baal. And then he says what he's going to do for his people, whom he is chastening for their sins, but whom he will bring again at the end of time.
My Lord, in covenant, I'll write upon.
Grace of our Lord Jesus Christ be with you all.